Thank you, Miigwech. Kowe nui oji buen bungi, winda munugo gizi Miigwech, winda man apiji, and enimiguan, but a jayan, the nadamagian bungigo, and endaman the wajge, ge do the monk, where any sad the gekenement wa all, ogima, bagunegi, jekajina kazat. Kowe dasha, nanisado taguna, oji buemuyan, kawin ganabach. I guess English. I guess I do have a dream that one day we'll be able to have lectures and classes and so forth about native history and native languages. We're trying to move in that direction. So I want to thank everybody for coming here today. It's really an honor for me to come here and share some things about my research on Ojibwe history, local history. And I found lots of interesting and surprising things about this gentleman named Hole in the Day, or Bagune Gijik. I guess, first of all, who is Hole in the Day? Because there are a couple guys with this name. So one would be famous in local history, the Hole in the Day from Leech Lake. And he's featured prominently in the last battle between the United States government and an Indian tribe in 1898, not so terribly long ago, and really a fascinating figure in his own right. We could spend the entire time here today just speaking about him, the events surrounding that particular battle, and they tie very much into the construction of dams, efforts at obtaining resources from northern Minnesota. We had a railroad boom, a timber boom, agricultural boom, all at the same time that transformed America into, you know, the leading industrial superpower in the world and the producer of most of the world's food. It was incredible, and so many of these resources were right here in Minnesota. That's one fascinating story. That's actually not the one we're going to be talking about today. There were a couple of other people with the name Hole in the Day. The gentleman we'll be speaking of, he was originally from central Minnesota around Crow Wing. If you ever drive down to Brainerd, you'll pass Hole in the Day Drive, Gull Lake, Fort Ripley, south of Brainerd. And this is kind of his neck of the woods and stomping grounds. He's really a fascinating and very controversial character. He signed almost every single land cession treaty between the Ojibwe and the United States government in Minnesota. And even the ones that he did not sign, which there were only two, he was intricately involved in the diplomacy and events around there. So he was important in that regard. But he was also really, really important because we can see a shift and change in the nature of Ojibwe leadership, of which he was both an observer and an actor. He intentionally tried to change the nature of Ojibwe leadership, and he simply had incredible power, things that surprise us very much in the way that he was able to deal with the United States government, force changes in policy. He was constantly intervening in American affairs. So usually we think of Indian history as the history of the U.S. government intervening in tribal affairs and taking over the land and things like that. But we can see Hole in the Day intervening in American affairs and the affairs of the Dakota and the Ho-Chunk. And he's traveling tirelessly to effect political change, economic empowerment. He infuriated everybody. I guess one of the fascinating things about this story is that there were very few significant groups of people in any position of power who did not have motive to kill him. And when he was killed, that was a pivotal moment because prior to that, Ojibwe leaders acted in their own regard. They were the sovereign rulers of the land, and not just as a consequence of land loss, but as a consequence of his assassination. There's a shift, and the United States government appoints Indian agents that now control and manage affairs on an Indian reservation. Prior to his death in Minnesota, payments for land sales and treaties went to tribal chiefs who set up roles and distributed amongst their people. They were the financial arbiters and power brokers. But after his death, it becomes the non-native Indian agents who control this, and tribal leadership is pushed aside and greatly disempowered economically and politically as a result. So really, really important events. So the focus on him is to really understand this larger narrative about power and dynamics and the nature of leadership in Minnesota. But I also had many different goals with researching and writing about Hole in the Day. One of the things I found with the discipline of history was a personal frustration about the nature of research. When I went to school at the University of Minnesota, I had a couple of experiences where that kind of put me at war with my discipline. One of them, there's a language requirement at the University of Minnesota if you're pursuing a PhD, and they require at least two other languages. So, you know, if you study German history, it only makes sense that you would need to know German, French, English, because they're primary source documents in those languages from all the different countries and people that interacted with Germany. And when I wanted to study Ojibwe history, I was told you should learn, well, of course, English, French, and Spanish. And I said, this doesn't make any sense. You'll only ever be able to understand what non-native people have to say about this history if you limit yourself to European and American source documents. And certainly native people have to have something to say and something that they know about this history. So I had to kind of battle right off the boat into graduate school. And to the credit of my advisors and the people I worked with, they did allow me to work with Ojibwe language, Dakota language, English, and so forth. So that was one of the battles. I also had one of my professors, who will just remain nameless at this point in time, tell me, you know, I'm not sure if you should be studying Ojibwe history at all. You're too close to the subject matter. And I said, is this really coming from a white man who wrote 20 books about white male history? And he said, oh, well, go ahead then. But oftentimes there are kind of built-in assumptions that, you know, if you're native, you're too close to the story, but they don't apply the same lens the other way around. And there are also assumptions that oral history is invalid, that if you whisper something in someone's ear and they to someone else comes around the table, it's totally different when it comes out the other end. And one of the things I was hoping to do was find Indian voices about this history and weave them into the story. I had every intention of exhausting the archives too, which we did, but I wanted to find, you know, some native voices, show native people as actors, not just passive recipients of their history, and see what else was different and what would give us different perspectives. And I was really pleased to see that we found a lot of things different. Here's Melvin Eagle. He's an elder from Mille Lacs, still alive. I'm not sure how much knowledge you have about, you know, 19th century Minnesota history, but there were a couple of things going on in that time period that were really pivotal. One of the big events that went on in 1862, there was a major conflict between the United States government and the Dakota Indians. And there were anywhere from 400 to 800 white settlers who were killed. And I guess the range of estimates is anywhere from 100 to 1500, but probably somewhere in the 400 to 800 range. It was incredible. It was an event that catalyzed national attention on a level of the World Trade Center event. You know, it was really pivotal. And immediately afterwards, the Dakota were forcibly removed from the state. The Ho-Chunk, or Winnebago, who had nothing to do with the conflict, were also forcibly removed from the state, and efforts to relocate the Ojibwe out of the state and then later to White Earth, where the policy would be focused, were redoubled right after the event. That much is really well known. There are, you know, dozens of books written on the subject. What isn't quite as well known is that there was a major altercation in Ojibwe country at the same time, and Hole in the Day was right at the center of it. So in 1862, on the same day that the conflict is erupting in southern Minnesota, Hole in the Day sends runners up to Leech Lake and all over Ojibwe country saying, the Union Army's here, they're going to be conscripting our young men to fight in the war, we need to take over the annuity agencies, take prisoner the Indian agents and the missionaries, and we need to join this conflict. So in Walker, they take him to heart. The Ojibwe leadership takes prisoner the missionaries. The Indian agent, Lucius Walker, is running for the cities. He actually lost his mind and committed suicide on the way down there. And then the Leech Lakers start marching down to Crow Wing to find Hole in the Day is sitting there in a chair doing nothing. He lied to them. Ojibwe warriors from Mille Lacs come over to Fort Ripley and surround the fort facing out to protect it from Hole in the Day and other would-be Ojibwe attackers. Now, we know all of this from the archives. You know, the army chaplain's writing in his journal, "It's amazing to see all of these Indians who've come to the fort and they're protecting us." You know, and so you can get that from the archives. But what we couldn't know is really the most interesting question, which is, why? Why would they do that? I was talking to Melvin Eagle from Mille Lacs, and he said, "Boy, let me tell you why. That was my grandfather who did that. I'll tell you what he told me about why they went over there." The Mille Lacs leaders did not like Hole in the Day. Hole in the Day was always trying to usurp their power. He was always saying, "I'm Grand Chief of all the Chippewa Indians," and he wasn't. He would sign land cession treaties that affected Mille Lacs that were signed by two chiefs, Hole in the Day and one of his subordinates. The Mille Lacs leadership weren't even consulted, even though it affected their land. Of course they were mad at him. Of course they wanted to prohibit him from bringing the wrath of the United States government down on them. So all of a sudden, the pieces are filling in. Oral history wasn't someone whispering in someone's ear and it coming out different at the other end, and you had to, you know, take it with such a grain of salt as to not even include it in a history book. All of a sudden, it was answering really big questions. So that's one of the things that was a little bit different about this work, was the incorporation of oral history. I actually did interviews with about 50 different Native people, and most of those were conducted in the Ojibwe language, although I also talked to Dakota people, Potawatomi, all kinds. And I think that's one of the things that's different. You can kind of get some Native voices about the history woven in that way. And they provide important anecdotal information and sometimes surprising things like, my father had been doing some research on Hole in the Day. And in the 1970s, he met this banker from Brainerd named John Pete Humphrey. And Humphrey confessed to my father that he had dug up Hole in the Day's grave hoping to find his chief medals and things like that. Kind of horrific that people were still doing that in the 1970s. But in any event, he was conscience-stricken and so forth. But what was interesting, probably most interesting about the story, is that when he dug up the grave, he found nothing. There was no body. There was nothing in there. And when I was talking to one of Hole in the Day's great-great-granddaughters, she said, "Well, of course there's nothing in there. They moved his body as soon as they had buried him. The family wasn't even at the burial. There was a Catholic priest who was officiating, and the family, after they walked away, dug him up and brought him over to White Earth. We all know that. Had I limited myself to the archives, or my father limited himself just to archival research, there was all this interesting information that never would have come to light. We really don't know where his body is. It was somewhat kept secret. It raised more questions than answers, but helped fill in pieces and raise interesting points about what this history is and what it all means. Of course, language is really important. I'm always telling the deans and president of Bemidji State University that if anyone calls and asks for the Department of Foreign Languages, to be sure to direct them to the English department. And indeed, there's really no better way to understand Native perspectives than to look at language. And if you're interested in this subject, I got lots of stuff I can show you, because a lot of my scholarship really revolves around other dimensions of language. But embedded in words is a unique way of looking at the world. So Ojibwe concepts about leadership, warfare, history, place names, you know, a little bit about the geography and topography around Lake Bemidji before construction of the dams. There were two lakes there. And it's really built right into the word Bemidji. Bemidji Gamag means the place where the current cuts across, because it's pretty unique. The river flows in, the Mississippi River, kind of by Dunn Brothers there, and it flows out just a little ways down the shore on the other side of the breck, instead of flowing all the way through the entire lake, which is really more common in the nature of waterways and so forth. But that's because we're right in the middle of a continental divide. And you've got the Red River watershed. From here, you can follow waterways and rivers that flow north and take you up the Red River. You can follow waterways that flow north and east you know, the Big Fork watershed and end up in Rainy Lake, and you can follow waterways south. That's why the Mississippi starts flowing north, and right in our lake, it gets pulled the other way and then starts flowing south. So all that's built into a word. So when you start digging at those words, you can get at much deeper understandings of place, event, people, perspective, and so really ended up helping a lot with the research. Also, as a matter of perspective, there's often this perception, and this is the way most history books are written about Indians, it's the history of U.S. government relations with an Indian tribe. But the Ojibwe had many relationships with the Dakota, with the Potawatomi, the Ottawa, with the French, with the British, and this web of relationships has a huge impact on events. One of the big reasons that the Ojibwe were not forcibly relocated from Minnesota like all of the other tribes in Minnesota is because the population straddles the border, and the Ojibwe, including Holdenaday, had a relationship with British officials and traders. And it became quite clear, because he had set the groundwork for this, when he was making threats in 1862, he wasn't doing it foolishly. He was smart and shrewd. He had a plan. If violence did erupt, they could go bring their families across the border into Canada and keep them safe, and from there field an army that would really not be encumbered by the needs to protect their families and their villages, one of the great weaknesses for almost any military campaign that American Indians had with the U.S. government. And they would have a much bigger population to draw from. It could have been really devastating. So when, and this is another part, looking in British archives, not just American archives, you see, you know, British officials writing to the American officials saying, there is a cousin of Holdenaday's up here in Canada who's making plans, contingency plans for some sort of war with the whites. And when this word reaches the U.S. government, they're like, okay, we're going to talk peace then. So if you limit yourself to looking at U.S. relations with the tribe, you miss a huge part of the story. The U.S. government didn't want to lose thousands of settlers and find no way to effectively punish those who were committing such violence and engulf another war with Great Britain. All of those things made them take a less violent and heavy-handed approach with the Ojibwe. Okay. U.S. Dakota conflict, 1862. This is just a picture of Little Crow, largest mass execution in U.S. history with the hanging of 38 Dakotas in 1862. So this is an event that was very much on the radar for the United States government. And just to give you an idea, you know, I explained a little bit about how Holdenaday had sent runners up to Leech Lake and other places, how the Mille Lacs leadership intervened, and they kind of prohibited a major outbreak of violence. Of course, Holdenaday made many, many enemies in doing this. But as a result of all of this, the U.S. government wanted to take Holdenaday captive and prosecute him for crimes against the country or something like that. And just to show you a little bit about how shrewd he was, and even when taking a hard antagonistic stance with the U.S. government, was able to exert power. I'll just share a real short section of this book with you. There was a council in 1862. William Dole, he was the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, was present. And this was part of the reason that Holdenaday precipitated all of this. He wanted to get a face-to-face with him. And there was no better way than to cause a little trouble. But in any event, at the council in Crow Wing, the effort of the U.S. government is now to arrest Holdenaday. So Dole shows up. They've got 100 U.S. Army soldiers there. They've, you know, greatly increased the garrison at Fort Ripley, and they're preparing to take Holdenaday captive. So just to give you a short explanation of what was going on there, the council at Crow Wing on September 10th, 1862, provided the stage for one of Bogune Gijik's craftiest diplomatic maneuvers. Bogune Gijik's just the Ojibwe word for Holdenaday. Most Ojibwe leaders from Leech Lake, Sandy Lake, and Mille Lacs were upset with the chief for lying to them. American officials wanted the troublemaker arrested or killed. John Johnson, he's another interesting character. The missionary activities in central Minnesota really involved a major conflict between Episcopalian and Catholic missionaries over who was going to have access to Indian souls. John Johnson was actually half Ottawa. He's darker than me. But he was working with Whipple as, you know, some of the Episcopal missionaries, often intervening in American affairs. But in 1862, when this event went down, Johnson feared for his life. You know, Hollandaise said, we're going to take all of the missionaries captive and so forth. So in a stage of panic, he threw his kids in a canoe, and the river was quite shallow there, and drug it down the river to Fort Ripley to safety. But in spite of the fact that it was a summer month, it was quite cold, his kids were wet, and two of them died from exposure. So when this went down, he held Hollandaise personally responsible for the death of his kids. In any event, Johnson was especially vocal about his desire to see Bugwana Gijik executed and wrote bluntly, quote, put a string around their necks, end quote. Chief Bad Boy and Johnson both wrote to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs that there would never be peace in Minnesota, quote, until he is disposed of, end quote. But Hollandaise was an expert at getting what he wanted, even when he seemed to have no remaining leverage. How could he get out of this one? Well, Commissioner Dole promised to come to the meeting unarmed and with no soldiers, but he secretly planned to capture Hollandaise and put him in prison. Bugwana Gijik suspected trouble and planned accordingly. Dole arrived with 100 soldiers and 25 white officials and settlers. Hollandaise brought 100 loyal Ojibwe warriors of his own. Dole curtly demanded that all white captives held by the Ojibwe be turned over immediately. Captain Hall tersely added that if the Ojibwe did not acquiesce, they would be, quote, blown to hell in 5 minutes, end quote. Bugwana Gijik gestured to the 100 warriors seated at the council, and then to the other 100 that appeared behind the American troops, effectively surrounding and outnumbering the American forces 2-1. He said that he was a friend of peace, but that he could not stop his men from defending themselves. Dole, chagrined and embarrassed at being outmaneuvered, said that he would be glad to hear the Ojibwe grievances. So, to make a long story short, there are all kinds of speeches. After Dole gets done talking, Hollandaise rises to give a speech of his own. The official government report said, quote, during the council he was insolent, defiant, and disrespectful. According to one account, Bugwana Gijik took apart Dole's speech, quote, from beginning to end, word for word, and when he got through, it was like a stocking that had been unraveled. There was nothing left of it. Hollandaise concluded, are you the smartest man that our great father could send in a trying time like this? Because if you are the smartest man the great father has got, I pity our great father. Well, so you think he's going to get anything? But he wasn't just there to insult people. Of course, he was emotionally charged. But he had all kinds of people, not just warriors running around Minnesota saying that the army's going to take prisoners. He had runners in Canada. And it was soon becoming clear that he was prepared for a major confrontation. Word reached U.S. officials, and who do they send to intervene but Henry Rice, who had negotiated most of the Ojibwe land cession treaties with the Ojibwe, Governor Ramsey, and they come in and they say, you know what, we're going to make this go away. Dole headed back to Washington. These guys sat down with Hollandaise and they gave in to just about every demand that he had. Incredible. And the demands were incredible. Like, the U.S.-Dakota conflict was precipitated in part by the fact that the Civil War was going on. They didn't have a lot of money. The financial payment for the sale of the land that was overdue arrived just one day too late to make a difference in preventing the conflict. And Hollandaise says, I want money and I want it now. And they cough it up. They even offered a personal payment to him. His house had been burned down during this event. They take care of it. No one was arrested or imprisoned or hurt. They were officially, Ojibwe leaders were officially exonerated. And incredibly, by personal diplomatic challenges to the government, which were largely unsupported by other Ojibwe leaders, Chief Hollandaise emerged victorious from the events. He secured promised annuities for the Ojibwe people. He obtained funds to replace his torched house. He was never arrested, imprisoned, or hurt. No Ojibwe people were killed. Bugwana Gijik knew exactly when to forge friendships, lie, threaten, cajole, bully, and back down. In his dealings with the Americans, the Dakota, and his own people, he proved his savvy as a diplomat and helped retain the sovereign power of his people. In one of the great paradoxes of the events in 1862, his triumph shows the fragility of Dakota, Ojibwe, and American power in Minnesota in 1862. So you can see him as this really sometimes controversial character, but quite an actor. By the time he was assassinated, he had offended just about everybody. So he had infuriated Ojibwe leaders from Leech Lake by lying to them. He had infuriated Ojibwe leaders from Mille Lacs by kind of usurping their power in all kinds of treaty negotiations. He had done the same thing at Fond du Lac. When it was time for the Old Crossing Treaty, 1863, that's the northwest corner of Minnesota, he writes to President Abraham Lincoln and says, "I understand you want to get land from the Red Lakers. I will go to the treaty negotiation and I will represent the U.S. government. If you want land, I'll get it for you." Lincoln writes back, to make a long story short, "No." He shows up at the negotiation anyways. He says, "I'm here to represent the sovereign Red Lake Nation. There's no way you're getting land from them." Crazy, huh? The Red Lake leadership says, "Who the hell is this guy?" And they're tapping their war clubs. They walk out into a private council, and then they walk right back in. Chief Holliday is welcome to sit here with us while we speak about this important agreement. Crazy. How did he do it? So, power, obviously, but controversial.